All right. Ever had one of those moments where you're walking and, slippery sidewalk, and suddenly you're thinking about, well, legal stuff? Maybe not the usual reaction, but today's case might change that.
Yeah, a sudden slip can definitely lead to some unexpected legal lessons.
Exactly. We're diving into Yarrows v. Trustees of the University of Pennsylvania. Now, it sounds like a simple slip and fall, right? But trust me, this case goes way beyond just a personal injury claim.
It really does. And for all you law students out there, get ready for a bit of a two-for-one special.
Ooh, love a good deal. What do we mean by two for one?
Well, this case tackles not one, but two crucial areas of the law. We're going to break down how appellate courts review decisions made in trial courts, and we'll also dig into those bedrock contract principles that come into play when you're dealing with settlement offers.
All right, so two birds, one stone. I like it. So let's set the stage here. What happened in this Yarrows case?
So we have Dr. Yarros. She's injured at an ice rink run by, you guessed it, the University of Pennsylvania, and naturally she files a negligence claim against them.
Makes sense. Ice rinks can be pretty slippery places, even for the most sure-footed among us.
Oh, absolutely. And this case actually went all the way to trial. Now, here's where things get interesting. During the trial, before those closing arguments, the university makes Dr. Yarros a settlement offer. They put $750,000 on the table.
Okay, $750,000. That's not chump change. Seems like a decent offer, right?
You'd think so, but here's the catch, and this is a huge point. The offer, it didn't come with a specific expiration date, no deadline attached.
Ah, I see where this is going. That missing deadline is going to come back to bite someone,
Oh,
isn't
it
it?
sure does. So picture this. The university's lawyer is in the middle of their closing argument, laying out their entire case, when suddenly, bam, Dr. Yarros, through her attorney, accepts that $750,000 offer.
Oh, snap. That's got to be a curveball for the university. So what happens next? They just say, okay, fine, you got us.
Not quite. The university cries foul. They say, nope, too late. That offer, it's off the table, expired. They argue that Dr. Yarros missed her chance.
This is why I always say, folks, the devil's in the details. A missing deadline can cause a whole lot of legal drama. And this is where it gets juicy for our law student listeners, right?
Yeah.
We've got a real-life example of how timing can be a major point of contention in a case.
Absolutely. And that brings us to the million-dollar question, or, well, in this case, the $750,000 question. What exactly is a reasonable time to accept an offer, especially one made during a trial with no clear deadline? And perhaps even more importantly, who gets to decide what reasonable means in this context?
Right. Because you've got the trial court where all the evidence is presented, witnesses are questioned, the whole shebang. But then there's the appellate court, which basically reviews the trial court's decisions. So where do those two courts fit into this whole reasonable time dilemma?
Well, in the first round, the trial court took a look at all the evidence. They considered the timing, the back and forth between both sides, the whole context of that offer, and they ultimately decided to side with Dr. Yarros. They said, yep, that settlement agreement, enforceable.
Okay, so round one goes to Dr. Yarros. But this is a legal boxing match, right? There's more rounds to come.
Oh, you know it. The university wasn't going down without a fight. They appealed the trial court's decision, taking it to the Superior Court of Pennsylvania. Now, here's a critical point for all you aspiring legal eagles. The Superior Court wasn't interested in rehashing the whole slip and fall incident. They weren't going to retry the original negligence claim.
Ah, so they were going to say, did Dr. Yarros really slip? Was the university really negligent? That part was done and dusted.
Exactly. They were focused on something much more specific. Did the trial court mess up legally when they decided to enforce that settlement? Did they say make the wrong call, legally speaking?
Gotcha. So we're moving from did someone slip to did the judge slip up?
That's a great way to put it. And this is where we take our first deep dive into the world of appellate review. When the Superior Court reviewed the trial court's decision to deny the university's post-trial motions, those are basically requests to overturn the settlement, they weren't asking, did the trial court get all the little facts exactly right? Their questions were much bigger. Did the trial court abuse its discretion? Or did they commit an error of law?
Okay, time for a legal vocab lesson. What do abuse of discretion and error of law even mean in plain English?
Right, because legalese can be a bit much sometimes. Think of abuse of discretion like this. The trial court made a decision that was completely unreasonable, like it came out of left field. Or maybe their decision wasn't supported by the evidence they heard, or they totally misunderstood the law. It's a high bar to clear. Now, an error of law is a bit more straightforward. The trial court just got the law wrong. They applied the wrong legal rule, or they misinterpreted a legal principle. Now, the key thing is, neither of these standards allows the appellate court to just say, we know better, and substitute their own judgment for the trial court's findings, as long as there's at least some evidence to back up what the trial court decided.
So the appellate court is giving the trial court the benefit of the doubt, to a certain extent. They're not just going to throw out the trial court's decision on a whim.
Exactly. And this is very different from something called a de novo review. In a de novo review, the appellate court would essentially hit the reset button and re-examine everything, both the facts and the legal principles, as if the case was brand new. But that's not what happened in Yaros.
So why this hands-off approach? Why all this deference to the trial court? It seems like a superior court could just review everything from scratch if they wanted to. What's the logic behind that?
Good question. There are actually a few solid reasons for this. First off, think about the trial court's position. They're right there in the courtroom. They see the witnesses, hear their testimony live, observe their body language, their tone of voice. They get a much more direct feel for the case than an appellate court ever could.
Right. The trial court has a front row seat to the whole legal drama.
Exactly. Appellate courts, on the other hand, they only have transcripts to work with. They're getting a secondhand account, so to speak. It makes sense to give more weight to the observations of the court that was actually there.
Makes sense. It's like the difference between watching a play live and just reading the script.
Perfect analogy. And there's another practical reason for this limited review. Efficiency. Imagine if every single appeal required a complete do-over at the appellate level. The courts would be completely swamped. Cases would drag on forever.
Talk about a legal logjam.
Oh, absolutely. And finally, this approach is all about respecting the roles of each court. We want the trial courts and juries to be the primary fact finders in our legal system. They're the ones closest to the evidence, so it makes sense for them to have the primary say in what happened.
Right. It's a matter of trust in the system.
Yeah.
Trusting that each level of the court is doing its job.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the Superior Court in Yaros actually spelled this out very clearly. They said, and I'm quoting here so you can see the exact language they used, "Our standard of review when examining a trial court's denial of post-trial motions is limited to a determination of whether the trial court abused its discretion or committed an error of law. We will view the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict winner and will affirm the trial court's decision if it is supported by any evidence on the record." They even cited Kramer v. Port Authority, a previous case that established this very principle. So for all of you studying law, this really underscores the structure of our courts, how those different levels interact, and the specific roles they play in the legal process.
It's like a legal hierarchy, with each level having its own specific responsibilities.
Precisely. So in the Yarrow's case, the Superior Court wasn't reweighing the evidence about the slip and fall itself. They were focusing on whether the trial court applied the law correctly when they decided to enforce the settlement. And this brings us to our second big takeaway from this case, which delves into the world of contract law. Remember, the university argued that Dr. Yarrow's took too long to accept their offer and that it had expired. So how did the Superior Court handle that argument?
Yeah, let's get into the nitty-gritty of those contract principles. We all know contracts are kind of a big deal in the legal world, so how do they apply to this settlement offer situation?
Okay, so we need to go back to contract law 101 here. One of the most basic principles is that an offer, especially one without a specific expiration date or a deadline, stays open for a reasonable time. That's a cornerstone of how contracts are formed.
Reasonable time. That seems a bit vague, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, what exactly does reasonable mean when you're talking about a legal agreement?
Could be open to interpretation, right? You're absolutely right. Reasonableness isn't some fixed mathematical formula. It's not like we can pull out a stopwatch and say, okay, time's up. Generally, courts treat it as a question of fact. That means it's up to the trial court, or sometimes a jury, to look at the specifics of each case and decide what's reasonable under those circumstances.
So they'll consider things like the nature of the offer itself, how the parties were communicating, any industry standards or expectations, that sort of thing.
Exactly. They'll look at the whole picture to figure out what a reasonable person would consider a reasonable time frame for accepting that particular offer.
All right, so back to our case. The university was basically arguing that once they started those closing arguments, that settlement offer was off the table, right? Like, by moving on to the next stage of the trial, they were signaling that the offer was no longer valid.
Precisely. They were pushing for what we call a per se rule, meaning an automatic rule. In their view, simply starting those closing arguments would automatically invalidate any offer that was still out there.
Hard and fast rule. No room for interpretation.
Right. But the Superior Court wasn't buying it. They flat out rejected this rigid, per se rule. They didn't agree that moving on to closing arguments automatically meant the offer had expired.
And I remember reading something in the court's decision that really stood out to me. They had some pretty strong words about the university's argument regarding their own lawyer's uncertainty about whether the offer was still valid.
Oh yeah, that was a key moment. The Superior Court actually called the university's claim preposterous. They found it unbelievable that the university would argue that their intention regarding the offer was clear, especially considering that during the evidentiary hearings, even the university's own lawyer admitted they weren't completely sure if the offer was still good after those closing arguments began.
So even their own lawyer was like, I don't know. That's got to hurt.
Right. If the lawyer making the offer isn't even sure if it's still valid, how can they expect the other party to know? The court wasn't impressed.
Okay, so what were the specific contract law principles that the Superior Court relied on to reach their decision? Because I'm sure our law student listeners want to know how those legal doctrines come into play in a real-world case.
Absolutely. The court highlighted a few crucial points. First, they reiterated that fundamental principle we discussed earlier. An offer without a specified expiration date remains open for a reasonable period. They emphasize that settlement agreements are just like any other contract, so the basic principles of contract law apply. And they specifically cited the principle that an offer is rejected when the offer, the person making the offer, can reasonably infer from the other party's words or actions that they don't intend to accept the offer or are still considering it.
So in this case, the court didn't see any indication from Dr. Yarrows that she had rejected the offer or was no longer considering it.
Right. And that's why the Superior Court ultimately upheld the trial court's decision to enforce the settlement agreement. They found that Dr. Yarrows' acceptance was valid, even though it came during the university's closing arguments.
So the big takeaway here for our listeners is that clarity is king when it comes to contracts, especially in a high-pressure environment like a trial. If you're making an offer, you need to be crystal clear about how long it's on the table.
Couldn't agree more. A simple expiration date or deadline could have prevented this whole legal battle. It's a valuable lesson for any aspiring lawyer. Always make sure those settlement offers have clear and explicit deadlines.
Absolutely. So, beyond this practical tip for our future lawyers, what's the broader significance of this Yarrows case? Why should law students remember this particular ruling?
This case reinforces some key principles about how our legal system works. First, it shows how much weight appellate courts give to the decisions made by trial courts. As long as there's some evidence to support those decisions, the appellate courts won't just step in and substitute their own judgment.
Right. It goes back to that idea of trusting the trial court to make the right call based on what they see and hear.
Exactly. And the Yarrows case also reaffirms some well-established legal principles in Pennsylvania, specifically about how appellate courts review decisions on post-trial motions. It's a good reminder that the law isn't always changing on a whim. There's a consistency and predictability to it, which is important for everyone involved in the legal system.
So taking a step back, our deep dive into Yarrows v. Trustees of the University of Pennsylvania has shown us a really interesting intersection of legal concepts. We've seen how the rules of procedure dictate how appellate courts review those lower court decisions, and we've explored how the fundamental principles of contract law determine whether a settlement offer is still enforceable, even in the middle of a trial.
Exactly. It's a classic example of how seemingly simple situations can become complex legal battles. And for the university in this case, overlooking those fundamental aspects of contract law ultimately led them to a binding agreement that they probably didn't anticipate when they started their closing arguments.
You snooze, you lose, as they say. Or in this case, you argue, and you might just end up agreeing to a settlement you didn't want.
Precisely. And that raises a thought-provoking question for our listeners to consider. Given the court's emphasis on the reasonableness of Dr. Yarrows' acceptance, what other factors, beyond a specific deadline, could influence a court's decision about what constitutes a reasonable time for accepting a settlement offer? Food for thought, folks.
Absolutely. Yarrows gives us a great starting point, but the world of contract law is full of nuance, and each case brings its own unique twists and turns. So keep those legal minds sharp, and we'll see you in our next deep dive.
Until then.